could allow us, and we are ready to make a meeting at any time in order to lift the immunity, as you said. But well, he didn't provide
so
us with anything tangible.
It's now basically in the hands of Judge Bitar and what happens next. But Lebanon is at a decisive crossroad now, with Najib Miqati being the new prime minister designate instead of Saad al-Hariri. And people are criticizing his name, especially that Miqati has a responsibility to uphold, since he was prime minister when the ammonium nitrate entered the Beirut port, and he knows about that. What will Miqati be able to achieve here that Hariri was not? And what is your main concern as Hezbollah for the upcoming political and security reality in Lebanon? We have seen over the past couple of days a huge dive in security.
I'm not in a position to defend Prime Minister designate Miqati or to attack someone else. It's only that we have a way in order to come out of this problem. What is the way? The only way is to have to form a government. Now, who was nominated to this position? You know, when we talk about Lebanon, we talk about the priorities. We have a political system who come into a deadlock. We have a structural deficit. We have structural disorder in the political system itself. Now we are, as just like what you said, in decisive, very sensitive, very crucial position in the economic level, in the political level, on every level. Now, Saad al-Hariri, who was not successful to form the cabinet, he named in the name of the Sunni majority. Let's accept it. We live in a confessional system. He named Miqati to this position, and that's why we accepted this, and we have nominated him. We have named him. Why did we do that? Because this is the only way to try to make an attempt to come out of the stalemate of the problem of the crisis.
So hopefully we look forward into forming a government soon enough to try and lift the country from the political and economic challenges it is.
We don't say that we don't have problems. We don't say we don't have problems. We don't say that there are no flaws or mistakes. But this is the way that would lead us out, and hopefully we can do it.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, part of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. It is very difficult for you, dear youths, who have not seen pre-revolutionary era, to imagine what things were like back then. We used to live at that time. We breathed it. At that time, the people had no role whatsoever. If someone had said to the people that they had the right or the power to get involved in the matters of the country, they could not have believed it. The people were completely on the periphery and had no role whatsoever. This was the case in particular during the dark era of the Pahlavi dynasty. We experienced the latter parts of it, the last 20-30 years. The people were like that at that time. They were living with fear and suppression. Imam took a huge leap forward, this way bringing the people to the arena and helping youth and the whole nation to believe in themselves. He employed the great capacities of the people and polished them with his leadership and guidance to such an extent that the people managed to accomplish a great marvel by overthrowing a millennium-old monarchy. He brought the people to the middle of the arena, helping them to stand firm, to resist, and to become stronger on a daily basis, thanks to their religion and their understanding. One day, the Islamic Republic used to be a thin sapling. Today, however, it is a good, strong, and sturdy tree which cannot be uprooted with any storm. Difficult incidents took place, but this nation managed to protect itself amid those difficult incidents and to move itself forward. An example of these difficult incidents is the 8-year war. For 8 years, all great powers stood behind a government so as to help it to attack us. They equipped it with information, with tactics, with financial assistance, all with the purpose of annihilating the Islamic Republic. Nonetheless, our nation stood firm, brought them to their knees, and refused to surrender and to kneel despite their foolish desires, and it expanded its zone of power and dignity.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet morning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese to serve justice and hold accountable everyone whose involvement is proven by the investigation. Today, I restate my pledge that no one is above the law, no matter how high they may rank. Let justice go all the way in probe and the trials.
Aoun stressed that the funds given to Lebanon from the International Monetary Fund must be spent in the best way to face the collapse and embark on reforms, one of which is forensic auditing, which he highlighted as very significant. This event comes as Lebanese officials are yet to form a cabinet. Demonstrators' anger is not only at the injustice in the Beirut port case, but at the ineffectiveness of the political class in dealing with the crisis. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, with a prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty, before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation, that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ebrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said he will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers.
Coming from the Persepolis camp, Ebrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Since the armed resistance against Indian rule began in Kashmir in 1989, New Delhi imposed a ban on Muharram processions in Indian-administered Kashmir, reasoning these processions might be used by the pro-freedom outfits to instigate the anti-India sentiments. Despite being challenged in the court of law, the ban remained intact. However, in a surprising move, New Delhi's administration this year lifted the ban. But more than appreciation, this decision has received criticism. Aga Said Rahullah Mehdi, former member of Kashmir's Legislative Assembly in the past, has often contested the government's ban on Muharram processions. Mehdi says each time security agencies would give negative feedback.
While you have called off Amarnath Yatra, for which you mobilize entire security grid of the nation to enable that, and at the same time you didn't allow the Eid prayers for the last couple of years, and this year including, and the best example to give is the Friday prayers at Central Jama Masjid, the central mosque of Grand Old Mosque of Srinagar. And it has been more than 100 Fridays that the prayers were not allowed or not allowed in that mosque. And while all this is happening, all of a sudden in isolation, you give a permission to a procession for which you denied the permission for 30 years. So to me, it is more questionable than it answers. And I have suspicions.
Mathi says this decision by New Delhi has more to do with building a fake narrative and dividing the people of Kashmir on the communal lines.
I do not want the other section of the society to be suspicious about this section of the society, that they have the patronage of New Delhi, that they have the patronage of BJP government. If we suffer through it collectively, if we find ways to fight against it, to come out of it, we find the ways and go on those ways collectively. I do not want to see 10th Muharram procession after the gap of 30 years suddenly come up as a procession not for Imam Hussein, but for the narrative building of a fake normalcy for Narendra Modi.
Locals too are apprehensive of this move amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Let them not play politics on this at least. This is a religious matter. If they think that allowing this procession will portray normalcy, they are risking lives. I don't think this was the right time to lift the ban. This simply means they don't care for the people.
After facing huge criticism, the government has revised the decision and passed the ball into the local administration's court. Since the decision of whether the Muharram procession be allowed or not has to be taken by district administrations, it remains to be seen how well they stage and whether people participate or not. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Few hours after President Qais Saied's decisions were published in the official gazette, Tunisian security forces arrested lawmaker Yassine Ayari to serve a 2-month jail term handed down to him by a military court in 2018.
Everyone who erred must be held accountable, but a civilian may not be tried in a military court. Everyone who committed a crime must be arrested regardless of the circumstances of the trial.
Judge Bashir Al-Akrami was placed under house arrest after being accused of covering up terror-related files, obstructing investigations into them, and violating the law regarding the files of political assassinations. Hours later, security forces raided homes of other lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary, including Muhammad Al-Afis, Saifuddin Makhlouf, Abdul Latif Al-Alwi, and Maher Zaid, who was arrested and then released.
May God bless the president. We thank Qais Saied. We thank him for the decisions. Poverty and unemployment have overwhelmed us. I'm a Tunisian woman begging for money to buy medicine, and even my husband's salary has been seized.
About lifting the immunity of the deputies, I neither agree to nor oppose the decision. I support the enforcement of law.
On August 2nd, Tunisian security forces arrested Member of Parliament Faisal Tibini under summons issued by the first instance court in the state of Jandouba. Tibini was charged with spreading false news and offending others through social media. He also faces three other similar charges. Raids and arrested lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary have opened the door to accusations against Saied, while leading political parties in Tunisia accuse the president of orchestrating a coup. Rights activists are concerned that the measures could open the door to further violations of citizens' freedoms.
Raids, arrests, and placing a deputy in prison to implement a ruling issued by the military judiciary opened the door to accusations against Saied, leading political parties in Tunisia accuse him of a coup. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered a significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khalid Al-Qanwa, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khalid today when I saw other students. Khalid was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khalid's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khalid was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khalid, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts. But due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have 3 of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khalid was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel his loss in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abulauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success, being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with their test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
A tearful farewell to Craig Murray from his family and supporters as the 62-year-old former diplomat hands himself in to Edinburgh police. In May, Scotland's second most senior judge accused Mr. Murray of deliberately risking jigsaw identification, an obscure term meaning if pieced together, his posts could have led readers to identify women who made sexual assault allegations against former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, a charge Murray denies. But the UK's Supreme Court refused to hear his appeal last week.
This is an absolute disgrace. If they had to punish him, which I don't think they should have, because the evidence and the charges were so tendentious and so tenuous, they could have put him under home arrest or house arrest, put him on a tag. And if that wasn't enough, at least put him in an open prison. He is not a threat to society. The people who put him in prison are.
Mr. Murray is not only known for his Alex Salmond blog posts. The independent blogger is a dedicated defender of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in a UK maximum security prison. After his sentencing in May, Murray released this tweet saying he had been banned by judges from traveling to Spain, where he was to give evidence in a criminal prosecution over CIA spying activities against Assange.
He's been a great comrade of Julian Assange. I myself have been privileged to share platforms with Craig at Julian Assange solidarity meetings, and I can tell you he is becoming more and more popular. And what they have done in their infinite stupidity, the people behind this decision, that includes the Supreme Court in London, which refused to hear an appeal against the original sentence in the Scottish courts. What they have done, they've made him into a martyr. And when he comes out of prison, he will come out much stronger, and they will be much weaker for it.
Craig Murray became the UK's ambassador to British ally Uzbekistan in 2002, but was removed from his post only 2 years later, after his revelations on human rights abuses and torture in the former Soviet Republic became an embarrassment to the British government.
Craig Murray was part and parcel of the establishment, but rose against it. Campaigners say his incarceration, the first in this country in 50 years over a media contempt case, is political. and sets a dangerous precedent for freedom of speech and independent journalism. Saeed Pariza, London.
After winning the presidential election in June, Ebrahim Raisi now receives the presidential mandate from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And this means Raisi is endorsed by the leader to be the new Iranian president. The decree was read out during the ceremony. It contains instructions and guidelines by Ayatollah Khamenei about major issues the president needs to address in his tenure. During the ceremony, Ayatollah Khamenei hoped the new administration will solve the existing economic problems in the country. Former President Hassan Rouhani handed over power to his successor with a pile of incomplete political and economic tasks on the table, from snowballing inflation to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. Ebrahim Raisi vowed to adopt a better approach toward those issues, a new approach that would remove U.S. sanctions and improve people's livelihood.
Change is what our people demand from the new government, and this change is inevitable. People's livelihood has been damaged, and they have lost their trust in the government because of the economic woes. My administration will try to lift sanctions, but we will not tie people's livelihood to the West.
Raisi won the 13th presidential election by a landslide on June 18th. He is affiliated with the Principalist Camp, which adopts a hard line regarding the U.S. and believes negotiations with American officials would be futile, since they're not trustworthy.
Under the Iranian constitution, any president-elect needs to have the endorsement of the leader before assuming office. Without it, their presidency would be null and void. And now that Raisi is granted the leader's mandate, Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Guantanamo Bay, where U.S. officials claim to be used as a detention facilities for hundreds of the most wanted terrorists on the earth, mainly Al-Qaeda and Taliban members. But there were dozens of prisoners who were not terrorists, but freedom seekers who were following their goals via peaceful attempts. The late Dr. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Shah Mousavi Gardizi, or the prisoner number 1154, was one of them. He was brutally tortured by the U.S. forces during his nearly 4 years of detention in U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay. The late Gardizi was known as a popular political, cultural, and social figure in Afghanistan. He, along with 35 others, lost their lives 3 years ago after two Daesh terrorists detonated their explosive belts among them during Jummah prayers in a mosque in Gardiz, the capital city of southeastern Paktia province. Now, along with the arrival of the third martyrdom anniversary of the late Gardizi and 35 of his relatives, this webinar is launched to pay respect to him as a great man, as well as to review the American model of human rights and democracy. In the eyes of the attendees of this webinar, the U.S. just follows its own geopolitical goals under different slogans. And when it comes to dealing with anti-arrogance figures like the late Gardizi, and then this is American gun that operates instead of law, regulation and humanitarian values.
America, as the United States, claims it's defending human rights, but persons like Dr. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Shah have neither held weapons nor committed any attempt against our national interests. He just sought to provide services to his own people and carry out intellectual and cultural activities.
The Americans did not come to Afghanistan to build a nation. Their main goal was to keep a close eye on the regional countries, mainly the U.S. rivals, including China, Russia, and Iran. Slogans such as human rights and democracy serve only as a tool at the hand of the U.S. to pursue its geopolitical goals.
It seems that the late Gardizi had already realized that the American model of human rights and democracy have no place in Afghanistan. That is why he seriously resumed his cultural and social activities in his hometown, Gardiz, after he was released from Guantanamo Bay.
The moves that the U.S. and NATO pursued under the guise of human rights and women's rights were often at odds with the country's indigenous culture. Later, all Afghans, mainly well-known figures like the late Gardizi, realized that the U.S. has been working for its own interests.
In the meantime, the attendees of this webinar insist on following the path of great figures like the late Gardizi as the symbols of strength, resistance, and freedom-seeker leaders. Sayyid Amin Alami, Kabul.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Turkish fires have been fueled by a southern European heat wave fed by hot air from North Africa, which has also seen chaos grip other parts of the Mediterranean in the recent days. Experts have warned that climate change is increasing both the frequency and intensity of wildfires. In this regard, we have prepared a news report for you written by staff of Al Jazeera English. This article is published under the heading, Wildfires Cause Further Devastation in Turkey and Greece. Stay tuned for more. Death toll in Turkey rises to 8. Greeks hospitalized with respiratory problems and many left homeless. The death toll from 6 straight days of wildfires in Turkey has risen to 8. While in neighboring Greece, firefighters were attempting to contain a blaze that has destroyed houses and hospitalized more than a dozen people. The Turkish fires have been fueled by a southern European heat wave fed by hot air from North Africa, which has also seen chaos grip other parts of the Mediterranean in recent days. Experts have warned that climate change is increasing both the frequency and intensity of wildfires. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis warned recently that Greece is suffering its worst heat wave since 1987, as forecasters said temperatures could reach 45 degrees in the coming days. The intense heat has helped fan wildfires that have destroyed more than 3,000 hectares of pine and olive groves in the country's west recently. Elsewhere in Europe, more than 800 flare-ups were recorded over the weekend in Italy, mainly in the south, the country's fire brigade said. A second straight day of wildfires in Sicily forced people to leave their homes and saw the local Catania airport temporarily shut down. In Spain, firefighters backed by water bomber aircraft battled a wildfire that broke out near San Juan Reservoir, about 70 kilometers east of Madrid. That blaze was stabilized overnight, but authorities urged people to stay away from the reservoir, a popular bathing spot for residents of the Spanish capital. Chandra Bhushan, chief executive officer of the nonprofit International Forum for Environment, Sustainability and Technology, iForest Research Organization, said the wildfires were linked with extreme temperatures, a longer drought period, a low level of humidity, and high wind speeds. Bhushan told Al Jazeera, there are climatic conditions being created which are so favorable for wildfires. That is why you're seeing all these incidents happening in the Mediterranean region. And all of them can be linked to climate change. in Turkey, two people died in the Mediterranean coastal city of Manavgat, raising the town's death toll to at least seven, Minister of Health Fertin Koca said. In recent days, at least one person has also died in Marmaris. 27 people were still being treated in hospitals in impacted areas, while thousands have been evacuated from their homes. Scores of fires across several provinces on Turkey's Aegean and Mediterranean coasts broke out, fanned by strong winds and scorching temperatures. While the majority have been extinguished, responders were still taking seven blazes in the coastal provinces of Antalya and Muğla, popular tourist areas, and in Tunceli, southeast Turkey. Many villagers have lost properties and farm animals, while locals and tourists have fled vacation resorts in boats. The wildfires are the worst of their kind in at least a decade, with nearly 95,000 hectares burned so far this year, compared with an average of 13,516 at the same point in the years between 2008 and 2020. Supports from Iran, Russia, and Ukraine have been deployed to help Turkish firefighters. Planes from Spain are expected to arrive, while one from Croatia will join efforts, an EU official said. Al Jazeera's Rasul Serdar, reporting from Managa, said international efforts and solidarity were ramping up amid the crisis. He said Turkey is going through its worst forest fires in its modern history now. Serdar added that Turkish experts had suggested it was very possible the blazes were triggered by climate change and global warming. In Greece, firefighters tried to contain a wildfire burning in the western region of Patras that destroyed homes and left 15 people in hospital with breathing problems after erupting over the weekend, local authorities said. Five villages in the area, which sits about 210 kilometers west of the capital, Athens, were evacuated. The mayor of nearby village, Dimitris Kalopoulos, called the situation an immense catastrophe. Flames consumed approximately 30 houses, barns, and stables in the villages of Zyria, Kamaris, Akias, and Labiri. We slept outside overnight, terrified that we would not have a house when we woke up, a Labiri resident told Greek TV station Sky. Firefighters were also tackling a blaze on the island of Rhodes near the Turkish coast.
Today. Think of a massive hemorrhage. The Iranian economy has bled out more than once. With the triple shock of sanctions, oil market collapse, and coronavirus, the COVID-19 to its system, it is in its third consecutive year of recession. Add a loss of water to the problems and you'll get the overall picture. The country is still standing, however, as with every challenge comes a chance. And the new government will be facing a flood of challenges, foreign and domestic, to turn around. Iran's first stroke, apparently mild but ground-setting, came towards the end of the Ahmadinejad era, when people saw their money devalued almost overnight by a double blow. As for sanctions, this country has been vaccinated against them by lighter doses over 40 years and more. And so it is ready to take whatever is thrown at it, but at the same time, it's been exhausted by constant blows. Which challenges must Raisi take by the horns first? And which untapped chances can he grab? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Mr. Kamali is Secretary General of the Islamic Labour Party. He worked with the Rafsanjani administration in a very different era. His challenge of choice would be...
You see, it's a matter of modernizing and rebuilding the economy. That is, pushing the economy toward competitiveness. Whatever activities being undertaken in the country must be done with the benefits and national interests in mind. We need to determine the layout and find out what can be done in which areas and how we can earn our revenue. The same goes for political issues. I've heard that Mr. Raisi says he's willing to form a super-factional cabinet. This is laudable, as he's committing himself to using national capabilities.
To see the full half, Mr. Sorhu lists all the good deeds he'd like to see done to jumpstart economic improvement. He is an analyst with reformist leanings and a construction engineer. And so, a favorite with him is housing. He's also a man of position with the welfare organization.
Constructing houses and buildings will activate some 150 other manufacturing industries. They should change the focus from building new houses in the suburbs and deserts. Something I noticed in Mr. Raisi's plan, which is a good one, that was also an objective of the former government, but wasn't implemented due to a shortage of resources. They can instead focus their attention on using metropolitan areas with worn-out buildings. They are potentially suitable construction sites as they already have all infrastructures, including access, water, power and gas.
Given the array of problems, each branching out into more than one and finally automatically interconnecting as a web, allow me to just go through challenges or prospective chances in a linear fashion to wrap up in our given 25 minutes. But first, the mention of what was a winning card for the Rouhani government. That would be the JCPOA, or nuclear deal of 2015, that limited Iran's nuclear program in return for sanctions relief and extensive foreign investment in this country. So you see, the Rouhani administration's grand plan could have saved the economy, except he put too much trust in the West, all his eggs in one basket, according to principalists. And former US President Trump just pinned the nuclear deal on a whim in 2018, and he added to sanctions that were. Now add domestic corruption to that, and you find Iran where it is. But that's not all on the president, as he is an executor of policies that are determined by the system as a whole. Inflation is always a biggie. It inflated further by this order. Sanctions stripped Iran of the bulk of its oil export revenues, so the country printed unbacked money. This unleashed liquidity in the market caused the local currency, or the rial, to drop further in value. And that gave us a fat lot of inflation. The rial depreciated eightfold in 3 years and now stands at around 250,000 rials to a dollar. And the inflation rate reached around 50% in March-April 2021, its highest level in 3 years.
When there's no supply of goods, in other words, when there's no jump in production, liquidity would naturally lead to rising inflation. On the other hand, you can't refuse to increase people's salaries, as what they're being paid is the bare minimum to make ends meet. So what's the basic solution so the liquidity won't cause inflation? That's increasing domestic production and reforming monetary, banking, and financial policies to benefit the producers.
The average rate of inflation in the last 12 months compared to its equivalent previous period reached 38.9%. The point-to-point inflation rate for essential commodities such as food and drinks reached 63%, while non-food goods and services increased by 43%. Mr. Sururi is chair of the Revolution Forces Coalition Council with similar priorities to Mr. Sorhu as a city council member. He squeezed in an interview with us after hours.
It's only natural to expect that Mr. Raisi's most pressing challenge would be controlling, or put it in better words, managing the liquidity. It's a grave risk to Iran's economy, but I believe we can turn it into an opportunity with some insight. We should make the country attractive for domestic or foreign investors and eliminate the middlemen and prevent the huge force which is destroying everything on its path and causing the collapse of the economy. I think the country has great attractions that could navigate the liquidity to boost the economy.
With the Rouhani administration, foreign policy would have been a guiding light to the economy. Raisi is also keen on reviving the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with the six world powers. But his approach and foreign policy outlook have been quite different. While Rouhani's look was to the West, Raisi is focused on neighbors and perhaps Russia and China relations. But how he times that and how situational and under control he keeps it is of great importance.
Would you say now is the best time to reinforce relations with China and Russia, the way things have been going in Syria and with the Sputnik production line in Iran?
In my opinion, there hasn't been a serious synergy between our foreign policy, our diplomacy, and our internal politics. The government didn't act as a link between them. That's why we're acting like we're independent islands in terms of our domestic and foreign policy. This would result in our missing great opportunities.
Raisi believes the priority should be resolving issues with Iran's neighbors before moving to the international level, and that can serve as a lever to pressure the U.S. with the nuclear deal.
Foreign policy in Iran is decided by consensus among key security and foreign policy institutions, and finally it's signed off on by the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The leader had indicated he was in favor of reviving the nuclear deal. But all those years ago, when he had originally given the go-ahead, it was with a usual expression of vindicated distrust for the U.S.
Raisi did stress the national line in his first news conference since the election, saying he would not negotiate over Iran's ballistic missile program or its support of regional resistance groups. It is now to be seen who he finally picks out for the cabinet, especially foreign minister.
Even if there was no JCPOA, our wrong policies would lead us to this situation. The JCPOA is a political agreement that could be a prelude to coordination and constructive issues and put a stop to some of the harassment and obstacles the West had imposed against Iran. Of course, since they have problems with us due to cultural differences and the way they look at us, even if the JCPOA is restored and implemented, a fraction of the sanctions might be lifted. But the others imposed for human rights and missile defense programs would stay in place.
It's not just foreign policy affecting relations. Corona has taken a bite out of the country's economic balance and relations also. How this little bug might be handled henceforth as it surges as a fifth and sixth wave, our guests will explain.
We have to accept the coronavirus pandemic as a reality and plan the economy accordingly. In that regard, I think the pandemic has created an opportunity for us, although it has also led to catastrophes. We're a country that was, and still is, somewhat reluctant to automate tasks. But the pandemic has changed our perception, and we're now believing that traditional approaches can't respond to the changing times. I think we've made great progress in smartization in the past few years.
In November 2020, stricter health containment measures were introduced after Iran registered over a million COVID-19 cases and the death toll climbed to under 50,000 deaths. The measures have been reintroduced with each wave of the pandemic but haven't been stably maintained on the balance. Constraints are a necessary vice, as the economic shock of the corona pandemic has pushed more households into poverty. To soften the shock, the authorities assigned new rounds of cash transfers and consumption loans for lower-income deciles and households without a permanent source of income. Social assistance and COVID-19 healthcare will continue to add to government expenditure growth. There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in. Here's to put it in actual words. The Financial Tribune talks of foreign policy priorities. JCPOA Saudi ties should be top of foreign policy agenda in next admin. The incoming administration needs to put the state of the 2015 nuclear deal and Iran's ties with Saudi Arabia on top of its foreign policy agenda, according to an expert on international affairs. I think the future of the JCPOA is an important issue that needs to be determined, Hassan Beheshipour said in an interview with ISNA. Resolving issues with Saudi Arabia is another top priority, according to Beheshipour, since interaction with this country has an important impact on Iran's ties with other neighboring and regional countries. Iran and Saudi Arabia are two neighbors and two major regional powers which are rivals at political, security, and economic sectors, but can also cooperate with each other, he said. Meh News tells of Raisi's domestic priority. People livelihood, top priority for future administration. A large number of lawmakers in the Iranian parliament met with Ebrahim Raisi, during which the president-elect stressed that people's livelihood will top agenda of his future government. Ebrahim Azizi, the lawmaker that represents the people of Shiraz in the Iranian parliament, said about the meeting between Ebrahim Raisi and the lawmakers that in the meeting the MPs expressed their viewpoints on various and important issues in the country with the president-elect. Azizi said that a large number of MPs were present in the meeting with Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi. The lawmaker said that in the meeting, urgent issues that need to be resolved quickly were raised and discussed with Raisi, adding that the possible ways to effective and constant interaction between the parliament and future administration were also discussed. Not to forget the importance of vaccines, Tehran Times has done a piece. Raisi calls for speedy vaccination drive. President-elect Ebrahim Raisi held a meeting with authorities and experts engaged in producing and distributing vaccines for the COVID-19 pandemic, urging an immediate action to vaccinate the citizens against the highly contagious virus. The meeting was attended by Health Minister Saeed Namaki, head of the Iranian Red Crescent Society, Karim Hemmati, chairman of the headquarters for executing the order of Imam Khomeini, Mohammad Mokhber, a number of lawmakers, the CEOs of producers of vaccines, managers of the institutions, and companies working on the distribution of vaccines, and the vaccine program experts, Tasnim reported. The campaign against controlling the deadly virus should continue unstoppably, he said, adding his future government will prioritize allocating the necessary funds for vaccinating the citizens. Undoubtedly, what has been done so far in areas of vaccination has been necessary, but definitely not enough, he added. That would be it for this segment, but there's more to come, so do stay tuned. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Ebrahim Raisi came forth with quite a few economic slogans for his presidential campaign. How realistic and readily achievable those are yet to be seen.
Because we are a developing country, there is a lot of ground to cover. We can do so much work that if a day was 100 hours long instead of 24 hours, we'd still be running short of time. I'm exaggerating, of course, but there's a lot of work to be done and many facilities to do it with, from manpower to material issues, which are now being left unused.
To go back to the beginning of the problem, the GDP growth rate dropped to -6% in 2018 and -6.8% in 2019. This is while the inflation rate increased to 30.22% and 34.6% in 2018 and 19, respectively. Much of the decrease in the GDP, gross domestic product, was associated with the huge drop in oil exports. Over $62.5 billion in 2018 to $29 billion in 2020. In 2020, while the economy struggled with a high inflation rate of 36.5% amidst the coronavirus pandemic and ongoing U.S. sanctions, the GDP started to recover. It grew to 1.5% after 2 years. However, given the ongoing political and economic challenges, the newly elected president will face difficulties in the economy and labor market, not to mention mismanagement and corruption.
Who owns what? Isn't everything all registered? Where do they publish this? Who has received loans? Some people receive money from banks and their names become classified. Who isn't willing to pay their debts? Who isn't paying taxes? All this means abetting the violators and a lack of transparency. If we are to act transparently, we need to continue all our activities within a glass room so everyone can monitor the officials and be able to assess their performance.
Raisi's first campaign speech was on May the 27th, and his promises were summarized in good governance to revive the Iranian economy. 7 broad promises were to give low-interest loans to poor households in the lower half of income distribution, to increase government subsidies for healthcare and decrease households' share in medical and health expenditures from 43% to 20%, to construct 4 million houses to create 4 million jobs, giving low-income people and graduates with tertiary degrees priority, and to decrease rent from 50% to 30%. How realistic these promises are, an expert tells.
I think the incoming government's policies towards building new houses are correct. The target of building 1 million housing units annually can potentially pull the brakes on the unbridled rise in the price and create a balance between supply and demand, ending this unimaginable situation for the housing sector.
Iran's political scene is pretty uniform now, with principalists dominating all three powers. Principalists basically claim it'll make it easier for them to take consistent, comprehensive economic decisions for economic reforms without in-house fighting getting in the way.
To get things done, when all three branches of the government think similarly, isn't an impressive feat. If a manager has access to 1,000 suggestions and can choose one among the many, he has done an impressive job. The more suggestions and ideas are at the manager's disposal, the better the decision would turn out. When we talk about the advantages of coordination, we are talking about the implementation of the plans. They should make the decision and then coordinate the efforts to implement it and move forward.
An effective pill for a suffering economy? Privatization, to eliminate rentiering and hoarding resources and to cause competition and create jobs. That's the idea, but not all resources are wise to fully privatize, and who gets to win enterprises as private investor is not easy to control.
According to the Constitution, the economic units and enterprises owned by the government should be transferred to non-governmental sectors, but this transfer also needs some considerations. The first and most important consideration is the competence of the people to whom these units will be assigned. Those who already work in the unit have the best skills to run them, because they are the ones whose livelihoods are tied to the growth and development of the production unit. And if they can get hold of the units in form of cooperatives and others, that could be the best case scenario.
With U.S. sanctions came lower oil export revenues, and the government, we said, tried to make up for this by printing unbacked money. The government also attempted selling its shares in major Iranian enterprises on the stock